and welcome to the Paper Club Podcast, where every month we invite a deeper insights expert to the show to highlight and discuss an academic paper from the data science literature. I am one of your hosts, Rafael Herrera, and my co-host today is Deeper Insights Chief Technical Officer, Dr. Tom Heselton. Welcome to the show, Tom.
Hi, Raf. Nice to be here.
It's great to have you here, Tom. You see, listeners, we are pulling out the big guns because today's guest is a PhD researcher and has expertise in AI, deep learning, and computer vision. He has over 16 years of experience leading research scientists in academia and industry, and he's authored a very interesting book called Understanding Deep Learning. He's currently a professor at the University of Bath. Welcome to the show, Professor Simon Prince.
Hi, Rafi. Hi, Tom. Pleased to be here.
We're really happy to have you here. I haven't read very many computer science books, but from what I've read, it's an excellent book on deep learning. And before we jump into the details of the book itself, I am curious, were you looking to write a book primarily aimed at experts, beginners, or people somewhere in the middle? What inspired you to write it, essentially?
So it is a technical book. It's targeted at scientists or people with some mathematical background, but not very much mathematical background. If you have high school math, you'll be able to read the start of it, and it gets straight into shallow neural networks, deep neural networks, how we train them, how we measure their performance, how we improve that performance. And later on, the book gets a bit more technical as we talk about architecture, convolutional networks, transformers, residual networks. And the latter half of the book, I'd say, is a bit more complicated still. So that might be targeted at people working in the field. And it covers basically generative AI, especially complicated topics like diffusion models and generative adversarial networks. So it's a mixture of things. It's not intended for the lay reader, but it's intended for scientists and engineers who want to learn about deep learning, but don't really have any background in this area. And it'll take you from the beginning right up to the cutting edge.
So it sounds like there's something for everybody on this one.
Absolutely.
I definitely want to say, when I was looking through this, I'm as beginner as it gets. I can spell math, but I do it without an S, unlike people in England. But what I found is you do a really great job of clarifying terms and making sure that all the charts are there and things are very clearly explained, providing context. So I definitely appreciate that just as a beginner. So I can attest, it does have something for everybody on that front. After going through the book, I was curious, the main thing that I was wanting to ask you, we built this thing that we don't entirely understand, but we do understand it. It seems very nebulous in that way. And I think, Dr. Tom, you probably know a lot more about this, but let's get into the details now. How is it that this even works? Why does deep learning work?
So I should say that the title of the book is sort of a joke because we don't really know the answer to that question. One thing's for sure, deep learning really does work very well. I'm not saying we don't understand the mechanics of it. We understand how to build these things. We understand how to make them work better than we could have dreamed of really 10 years ago. But there are lots of unanswered questions. And I think that's because there's sort of two groups of people working on deep learning. There's practitioners who are building these enormous models, ChatGPT and so on. And then separately, there's a group of theory people, and the theory is lagging behind the sort of enormous progress of the practitioners, which is obviously being driven by industry and so on. And so there are some pretty basic questions that we don't have definitive answers to. So we're fitting these incredibly complicated models to very large training sets. It's not really obvious why that fitting procedure should be easy, but yet we sort of take it for granted now. We can fit a really complicated data set using a large enough deep neural network. Another question is, having fit this model, why should it generalize to new training data, which it seems to do really, really well? Again, we don't really know the answer to that. We don't even really know the answer to questions like, why should neural networks have to be deep rather than shallow? We have this sort of landmark results, the universal approximation theorem that says, in principle, a neural network with a single layer, that is to say, a shallow neural network, can fit any function to an arbitrary degree of accuracy. If that's the case, why do we even need deep neural networks? And yet, in practice, it seems we do need deep neural networks. If the network isn't at least 10 layers in depth, let's say, results don't tend to be good. And we don't have, there's no sort of agreed on answer to even that basic question, why should the networks be deep? So there's a lot of open questions. We can dig into some of those things if you like.
It's really interesting hearing you say that, Simon, because that was one of the things that really attracted me to that book was the title. Because one is I thought, well, that's brave. and then shortly after getting into the first chapter, I realized, yeah, it's a bit of a joke, as you just said. As I mentioned, I was really attracted to the book because, I mean, many years ago, we worked together on some face recognition technology, and you were writing a book at the time, Computer Vision, Models Learning and Inference, which I found really helped deepen my understanding of machine learning in general. But this was pre-deep learning. And then all of a sudden, a few years later, this huge wave, starting with AlexNet, suddenly swept through all of computer vision. And it doesn't seem to have stopped. We've had wave after wave after wave of everything just getting beaten through the application of deep learning through the various forms, be it computer vision, convolutional nets, recurring neural networks, generative AI, and large language models now. And I thought, oh, here's a book that finally is going to teach me real understanding of why this thing works. But I was surprised to see, yeah, we still don't really know. And it's quite surprising that these things are performing so well.
There is a body of theory out there that addresses some of these questions, but it does lag behind the current performance. And often it makes sort of unrealistic assumptions about networks. You can prove things, for example, about fitting or generalization, but you have to make the assumption that the width of the network is the square of the number of data examples or something. So it doesn't really map to actual practice yet. Having said that, you know, our theoretical understanding is slowly catching up. I think what's really going on is that the economics of this, you know, drive development much faster than they drive the understanding. So it's likely that while we're still filling this enormous space of new models that deep learning has made possible, that will continue to happen unless there's, for some reason, another AI winter and development slows down. It's likely that the sort of practice of this will always outstrip the theory just because it's much better funded and there are many more people working in it.
Yeah, I hadn't quite realized myself that some of the theory and some of the ways of fine-tuning, been some new discoveries unearthed. And you mentioned a concept, I haven't actually come across it before, but double descent within the theory of deep learning, where the number of parameters, if that is increased relative to the amount of data points, that typically leads to better results. And I knew that was the case. We've seen instances of that a lot. I hadn't realized it had been investigated to such a degree. And actually almost seems to be a rule.
Right. So double descent is this sort of surprising phenomenon that bucks our sort of classical ideas about machine learning. So before the sort of current wave of deep learning, the sort of theory would say that as you increase the number of parameters of a model, to begin with, the test error decreases because the model's getting more flexible and so it can describe the data better. But at some point, it starts to increase again because it's now essentially described the main trends of the data and it's fitting to the noise of the data. So you're just fitting sort of random aspects of your data that aren't important. And so you expect this sort of U-shaped curve where the performance first gets better, the errors decrease, and then it gets worse. But what's been discovered relatively recently, only 5 years ago, is that if you keep increasing the parameters, so there's now more parameters than there are data examples, then the performance comes down again. And that's why it's called double descent, because that's where the performance improves again. So that's why it's called double descent, because to begin with, the errors go down, then they go up again when the number of parameters is about the same as the number of data points. And then as you increase the number of parameters further, the errors decrease again. And this is really surprising because once there are more parameters than data points, essentially what's happening in our training data is we're fitting the training data perfectly. So now we're adding these extra degrees of freedom to our model. It's not really obvious why that should help. In fact, it sounds like it might harm things because now the model can easily fit all of our training data points, and it can also has a bunch of degrees of freedom whereby it can do anything between them. So if anything, you would expect that to make things worse. But what actually happens is the performance gets better And the current theory is that what's basically happening is that it's using these extra degrees of freedom to interpolate more and more smoothly between your training examples. Now, that sort of must be happening because the test error is still decreasing, but there's no obvious reason in the way that we train the models, in the way that we set up a model, why adding parameters should create a smoother function. It can, in theory, do anything between our trained data points. Presumably, it's some combination of how we initialize things, how we train the model, but it's not well understood why that would be the case.
So my intuition would have been that that would just lead to greater overfitting, less generalization, and in the end, on a test set which is blind, worse results. But that is not what we're seeing.
Exactly, but it's a very reliable result there. You keep adding parameters to the model, the performance gets better. And recently discovered, a lot of work had already been carried on in deep learning, I think, in what they would call the modern regime, that is more parameters than there are data points. People weren't even necessarily cognizant of the fact they were in this situation because they were just doing this empirically, and they found that when you made the model wider in this way, performance kept getting better. Nobody was keeping track of this. So it is a surprising and counterintuitive result that, again, nobody really has a good answer to. There is some theory that says to smoothly interpolate between data points, you need roughly the number of dimensions of the data times the number of data points. So there is some theory that points to this, but it's not very intuitive. And as you suggest, yeah, it's counter to your, you know, initial guesses to what might happen.
There were a couple of things that you touched on earlier that I wanted to go back to. One of them was the idea of an AI winter. Could you explain that to me? Again, as an outsider, I don't know what that is. And does it have to do more or less with people are just not paying attention to AI and now all of a sudden they are? And is it an ebb and flow like that?
So I think the term comes from in the 1980s, there was a sort of first wave of neural networks and other kinds of AI like expert systems. And it was a massive influx of money. And what happened was it didn't really fulfill its promise. And then they refer to AI winter as that period from, say, about 1990 to 2012 when deep learning came along and did its thing, as a sort of period where industry perhaps was less interested in this and enthusiasm for it was less. Obviously, work in academia carried on. Since then, we've seen this enormous influx of money and interest and people in this area. And so when people talk about AI winter, they're sort of wondering if there will be another one. And I think there'll be another one if the promises people are making exceed the delivery of the scientists and engineers. At that point, industry will sort of withdraw its money and bet on something else. And we could face another AI winter. I mean, how likely that is a matter of debate. But
as somebody in the know, I'm curious, what promises are being made right now that you feel maybe we won't be able to deliver on as immediately as we want?
Well, it's very difficult because we're on an exponential sort of increase in terms of productivity and development in this area. And it really is exponential. If you look at the number of papers published in AI, it fits an exponential curve perfectly. Obviously, that can't carry on forever.
And the compute power has exceeded Moore's law just in the way companies like NVIDIA are approaching it and using parallel compute to go beyond the rate of Moore's law, increasing compute power purely to serve the likes of large language models in these very, very deep neural nets. So you've got the interest and the compute increasing at greater rates than we're used to. You put those two things together, the advancement is huge.
I agree. The reason I said it wouldn't go on forever was more just there's a limited number of possible AI researchers on the planet that will run out of. Eventually, everybody's doing science will be studying AI, and we will run out. Silicon aspects of this don't show any signs of slowing down, I agree, but there will be some limitation in the amount of AI researchers. One area where I think people have overpromised a bit is self-driving cars. Some years ago, people were talking as if we would already have self-driving cars now. Obviously, there's a lot of issues there to do with regulation and what have you. But we've seen California rescind the license of one self-driving car company this past few weeks at the time of recording because it did something unsafe. And that seems to have come much more slowly, just by enormous investment than people expected. And as more money pours into this, it's likely people will have to make excessive claims to capture the money. You know, we've seen this in other places. Crypto has obviously gone through. You know, it's naturally going to happen. It's really a question of whether we can, as scientists, keep up with investment at enough of a rate so that enthusiasm for this area doesn't wane.
Well, I think that ChatGPT probably ramped up the enthusiasm. If there's anything that I've noticed, it's that it feels like that was the quote-unquote iPhone moment for everybody. And everyone's like, oh, wait, AI can actually do things now. Because I remember when I was younger, AI only existed in my life on a digital camera where it would pick out where somebody's eyes were and you could take a picture of it. And that was it. That was as astounding as it could be. So it seems like we've definitely gotten mainstream with some of the applications.
Yeah, it's funny. I think people have been using AI for a while, but they haven't identified it as much. So people commonly use Google Translate, which is an amazing AI tool. I mean, it's complete science fiction if you're as old as me there. You can just type something in and it will translate it into any other language. But somehow that didn't capture the public's imagination so much. Likewise, image search, you know, where you can search your images if you store them in Google Photos or whatever for the contents of them. That was AI, but it didn't quite capture people's imagination. And ChatGPT absolutely is the first time that the general public is sitting around the dinner table talking about AI. I think if you worked in AI, it was less surprising because you'd seen GPT-3 and so on, and it was a sort of natural extension of a whole bunch of models. But certainly it's the first thing that the general public, is it going to be a landmark moment in terms of its impact on the general public?
I think there's a key reason for that. And it's that ChatGPT was the first thing that came around that felt human.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, arguably, it can pretty much pass the Turing test, or it can have a good go at it. The Turing test, if people don't know, was a test proposed by Alan Turing for a machine being intelligent, which was that it could communicate with you via text and you would not be able to distinguish whether it was a machine or not. I think you still can tell with ChatGPT, but they're not really training it to solve that problem. I wonder what would happen if they fine-tuned it to pretend that it was a human being, if it would pass that now. And there are questions about whether that's really a good test of machine intelligence anyway. But
so basically what I'm hearing is it's been with us the entire time and we just never knew it. I just thought things were really well labeled on the internet. I think that's honestly all it was. Something else that you brought up a little bit earlier is you were talking about these neural networks and everything. And I have a question more about depth and capacity, if that's all right. In practical applications, how do you balance the depth of a network with its capacity? And what are the trade-offs that are kind of involved in this?
So you have to understand that this is all done very empirically. So the depth of the network and the capacity are broadly speaking correlated. Basically, there are many ways to measure capacity, some of which are very technical, but a simple way of thinking about it is just the number of parameters the model has. And the number of parameters increases as the depth increases, but it also increases as the width increases and as you choose different architectures and so on. So they're correlated, but not exactly the same. All of this is decided empirically. So no one really has any theory about how deep your network should be, how much capacity it should have, how many parameters it should have. This is done by testing lots of different networks with lots of different capacities, lots of different depths, and empirically finding out what works best. Although we have some rules of thumb, more parameters is generally better, deeper networks generally work better, but deeper networks also cause numerical problems. And much of modern deep learning practice has been devoted to solving those problems. So, for example, in my book, there are chapters on residual networks. There's discussion of batch norm. There's discussion of how to initialize networks. All of those things are addressing how do we make networks deeper with more capacity and still work on a practical level so that the computer can actually train them effectively. And the main problem being that the numbers in the network become either very large or very small and can't be represented by the computer anymore.
Yeah, it's interesting to see that transformation from pre-deep learning where we're using traditional methods and you would pick the right technique. You know, you would say, right, we've got a sort of a priori probability distribution of this sort here, I'm going to go for that technique. I'm going to use a Bayesian model because that you know, nicely represents the sort of data we're working with here, or, you know, I need a decision tree because it's all based on the sort of binary yes, no's that you can work your way through. You know, you would fit your technique to the problem. Now, it's almost certainly just going to be deep learning will be the best. Would you agree?
I think that's true, but don't forget that there are many different deep learning architectures. So now within deep learning, you would choose an architecture that suits itself to the problem. So for if you're processing images, for example, then you would use convolutional networks. And convolutional networks are known to work well with images because they incorporate ideas such as the statistics of the image are the same at every place in the image. And you don't want to relearn what a tree looks like when it's on the left of the image versus when it's on the right of the image. You want to share that information. So to some extent, we still choose our models based on the problem. If our model is naturally based on a graph, we would use a graph neural network. Transformers are networks that take inputs of variable length, so they're useful for text, which where sentences are of variable length. But now all of those things are deep learning, you're correct. So
yeah.
The basic sort of framework has stayed the same, but within that, there is still some sort of fine tuning to your particular task.
Yeah, a network of neurons is going to do it. It's just, yeah, slightly different arrangements of those neurons. Are we getting any closer to having all this hyperparameter tuning, choosing the network architecture to a point where that is solved for us? So like some people are calling it auto ML sort of approach to it. Do you think that's realistic to think that will come, or how far off is it?
Well, it's just another optimization problem. So we have to search this enormous space of possible network architectures. And for each one, we need to train it and see how well it generalizes. So it's a very difficult optimization problem with many local minima. There are various techniques to apply to it, some of which, in fact, rely on older machine learning using Bayesian optimization, for example, uses Gaussian processes. I don't think we're at a stage where we can guarantee we can pick the best architecture. There are other more theoretical methods, like using neural network Gaussian processes, where in principle we can say things about how well this network should work without even training it, but the correlation between the predictions and reality is not 100%, to say the least. We're still quite far away from doing that, to the best of my knowledge. But it may be that some of these companies like OpenAI and Google have secrets that they're not making public.
One extra thing, just touching on that point, Simon, there one quote that did surprise me in your book was, I think you said something like, the association with biology is no longer helpful, or we've got to move forward without that. And I found that quite surprising, because obviously biology is the original inspiration for the neuron. We're still talking about collections of neurons. There's always been this slight disconnect between how deep neural networks work and how the human brain works. But there's also great similarities. But you seem to be saying, forget the biology, we're beyond that now.
Yeah, I make a point to try and not couch this in terms of the metaphor of neurons. In fact, I only use the word neuron 4 times in the book, and twice is to argue that we should never use the word neuron.
Okay.
I think it's misleading, and especially it's not so misleading if you work in the area. I mean, the background is that we don't really have any evidence that the brain works in any way similarly to how our current neural networks work. In our current neural networks, we calculate these sort of intermediate quantities, which are held at variables that we call neurons or hidden units. And when you draw a picture of how those connect to each other, it looks a little bit like the brain, in that it's got nodes that are collected, a bit like nerve cells that are connected to many other nodes, a bit like neurons in the brain connect to one another. But there's no evidence that the brain uses the same algorithms we do to either train or run this network. For engineers, it's not too worrying. It's just a different sort of terminology. But I suppose what I'm really worried about is the general public is going to start thinking that what we're doing here is building brains or something like them. And that's extremely misleading. So if you think, for example, that ChatGPT is having anything like thoughts, It is not having thoughts. ChatGPT is really better thought of as a giant equation where you put the question in one end and it predicts the answer word by word out of the other end. And I think it's going to be confusing for people who aren't technical if we keep referring to this in terms of the human brain, because there isn't really any evidence that they work in the same way.
Now, this is heartbreaking. You're basically telling me that ChatGPT isn't my friend.
Well, ChatGPT can pretend to be your friend, but I'm afraid underneath it's a cold-blooded equation just calculating using multiplies, adds, exponentials, and ReLU functions.
Yeah, like some of my friends too, Tom. Okay, so from your point of view, what do we know more about the human brain or how deep learning works?
Well, I'm not an expert on the human brain, but I don't think we have the tools yet to really understand it. You know, we have high-level tools where you can measure the blood flow to a certain area after you ask somebody to a certain task, and we have very low-level tools where you can measure of the order of hundreds of neurons at one time, maybe a bit more now. But there's a huge disparity. Basically, you're either measuring tens of millions of neurons or hundreds. And so it's very hard to get a sort of intermediate picture of the tools we have in neuroscience right now. I think I'm not an expert on neuroscience. In terms of deep networks, it's interesting because we're now building things that in terms of the sheer complexity are comparable, I suppose, with the human brain. And so there are two things. Like, one, what we've already talked about, why this kind of model should train well and work well, but also having built the model, we now want to understand it, and we don't have the tools really yet to know why ChatGPT chooses the word it chooses next or answers the question in that way. And so there's a whole field called explainability. Because in the case of ChatGPT, it's not too important, but if this is a neural network deciding whether you get a job or not, whether you're released from prison or not, it's important that we know why it gave the answer it gave. And the truth is, we do not have good methods for that, for deep neural networks yet. We can sometimes partially explain why a particular decision was made, but those explanations are quite limited. In terms of understanding the whole network itself, it's extremely opaque. And there's going to be discussions about this and whether these are the right kind of models to use for those critical applications where people's futures are at stake. My personal opinion, and this is opinion, is that we may never understand how an individual neural network makes its decisions. And we may have to live with that in the same way that we have to live with the fact that we can't really understand how a human being makes his or her decisions. It's sort of well known that you don't even have introspection to your own decisions. If somebody asks you, why did you do that? You can provide a reason, but that's well known to be sort of post hoc rationalization.
You're often finding a way to justify something that you've already made a split decision on.
Exactly. And you can manipulate people to prime them to make certain decisions, but then they will rationalize it in a different way. So we're comfortable with that with human beings because that's what we've grown up with. And we may have to become comfortable with that with AI unless we can find a model that is as explainable as Tree, for example, where it's very clear what it's doing, but has the performance of deep learning.
I was very intrigued to see that you dedicated a large portion of the book to ethics and regulation. And based on what you were just saying, you know, we don't really have a deep understanding ourselves of what's going on in deep neural network. Of course, this really begs the question as to what are the ethical considerations if we don't even really know what's going on inside? And should we even be meddling with this stuff?
All of this kind of reminds me a little bit of the movie Jurassic Park. We thought about whether or not we could before we thought about whether or not we should. We're just trying to uncover the secrets of this thing, this massive thing that we've built, and it's had such a tremendous impact on us too.
You see the recent AI summit on safety and existential risk. Are we going down that path?
Well, first to say, I don't really have any answers to those questions. It is interesting that I've essentially written an engineering textbook and it has a chapter on ethics. I feel really strongly that as engineers, we have to behave responsibly. We're making very powerful technology here that can be used for good or for harm. The point of that chapter is not to lecture anybody. It's to encourage researchers to think about how to develop AI responsibly. And one of those aspects that we've talked about is explainable AI. I should also say that chapter was co-written by a researcher called Travis Lacroix from Dalhousie University, which is in the east of Canada. He is an expert on AI ethics, and he comes from more of a philosophy background. So I didn't feel confident being an engineer that I could write a good, solid chapter on this topic. So I drafted him in. I should say he did most of the work and he should get most of the credit. And my job was really to try and translate his language of philosophy into something that engineers could understand. And if you want to know more about AI ethics, I know that he is currently preparing a book. There's going to be a draft available soon on value alignment, which is basically how do we persuade artificial intelligence applications to adopt the same values and to be aligned with the values of humankind. He's very concerned that we should behave responsibly with these technologies, that we should think about the stakeholders of these technologies, for example, the people that we're applying them to, that their voices should be heard, and that these powerful things we're building are not misused. And that should be an interesting read.
I was very encouraged to see the level of participation at the recent AI Safety Summit in the UK. It does seem as if people are taking this seriously. The inclusion of this chapter in your book, it just goes to reinforce that. It is being looked at. And I was quite surprised because often I think engineers get their head into solving the problem, and as you say, don't have an eye to the ethical implications. But are you encouraged by what you've seen going on?
I'm encouraged people are taking it seriously, but it's really hard to see a way forward for this. So there have been various developments recently. As you say, the AI Safety Summit at Bletchley Park. There's a G7 Global AI Governance Initiative. The European Union has an AI Act that they're working on, and there's been a presidential executive order in the United States, which it requires, I think, large companies working on frontier models to present evidence to the government that these things aren't damaging. But it's really hard to know what a good way forward to govern AI would be and to restrict it. You know, you could, for example, limit, if you want to control it, you could limit the production of GPU chips. To some extent, that's being done. The US will not export certain kinds of NVIDIA chip to China. But I don't know how practical that is. You could ban certain types of application, for example, surveillance applications, biometric surveillance from a distance. You can, certain bits of AI regulation will probably fit in existing frameworks. So things to do with bias and discrimination perhaps fit already within existing laws, but things like large language models have the possibility of doing great damage. You know, for example, they could teach someone how to make a bioweapon relatively easily. And because we have this problem with explainability as well, it's almost impossible to guarantee that for every question you ask one of these models, it will definitely give an answer that is not misleading, dangerous. We don't know how to handle that. There's a bunch of interest in industry and constraining the number of people who can develop these models. They argue that that's so that there's less competition and that doesn't encourage people to do reckless things. But other people would say, well, they're just saying that so that they have less competition. So there is serious interest in this, but I don't see an obvious way forward that's going to be successful, and we'll see what happens.
I am immediately going to jump to that section because I am very curious about all parts of the ethics side of it, because it does feel very much like, well, Oppenheimer, the film came out not too long ago, and it does feel like we're almost at that moment where like, okay, we've developed some technology that could be great or could be bad. What do we do now? And it seems fresh.
Absolutely. And if you think of the three people who won the Turing Prize for deep learning, Jeff Hinton, Yann LeCun, and Joshua Bengio, two of those people, Jeff and Joshua, have already come out and said that they expressed worries about this. So, you know, in some sense, we've already had a kind of Oppenheimer moment.
Interestingly, Yann LeCun disagrees, doesn't he? They have quite the fiery debate on the existential risk of these things. And that's very interesting to see of the the three that really championed and ended the AI winter and brought this technology back to the forefront, there isn't consensus even there.
No, there isn't consensus there. I don't want to misrepresent Leanne LeCun's views, but he is definitely more bullish. He feels like it perhaps is more dangerous in the hands of private companies than it is if it's made public. Meta, who Leanne LeCun works for, have a history of making their models and their even the training framework, PyTorch, public. And so he has definitely quite a different view on things than the other two.
Well, that's all encouraging, scary, and also I'm a little excited about it because I feel like there's a lot going on. And I think what makes this particularly unique is that we are having those conversations at such an early stage. So it's encouraging, at least on that front for me. Hopefully the actual experts feel the same. So that's good.
Your book is already out, and I notice you've released it as a physical book, which was quite interesting. I think you're in the current state of technology. We've just been talking about large language models and everything turning into online media, but you chose to release this as a physical book alongside the online access. Why is that?
So a lot of learning is done nowadays through MOOCs, these online courses, which usually have video content. This is a technical engineering book, though, and I feel like the only way to really learn complicated technical ideas is to interact with them closely, and watching videos online is a very passive form of learning. I think we've all been there. You watch one of those videos, and then you don't necessarily remember everything from it afterwards. Reading is a bit more active. Also, to sort of promote that idea that you need to interact with the material to really understand it deeply, I've released 68 Python notebooks. They are flagged in the text at the point you should do them. And each one illustrates an idea from the text, and it's missing a few sort of key lines of code that the user has to fill in using information from the book that hopefully will give people a deeper experience of learning, deep learning, and will help some of these ideas stick.
Where can I actually learn more about them, read them, actually interact with them?
So if you Google the book Understanding Deep Learning by Simon Prince, or you go to http://udlbook.com, you'll find my website. All of the Python notebooks are there, as well as answers to some of the problems from the book and other resources for instructors. And that's where you can find more information.
Simon, thank you very much. That's all been very interesting. I've had a great time chatting with you about all these very complex ideas, some of them terrifying and some of them very encouraging. So it's been fantastic. Thank you for taking the time to talk to us about your book.
My pleasure.
And if people have any more questions for Simon, listeners, feel free to reach out to him on Twitter/X, whichever you want to call it. His handle is Simon Prince AI. It's very on brand. Man loves his AI. And if you are eager to delve more into the subjects we've tackled today, obviously consider grabbing a copy of Understanding Deep Learning by Simon Prince, available now on the MIT Press website or wherever you buy your books. You can go to Amazon, whatever you wish. Go ahead, order it physically or order it digitally. Either one is great with us. The more people learn about this stuff, the better, I think. And I will have links to everything we discussed in the description as well. I also want to thank Deeper Insights CTO, Dr. Tom Heseltine, for being my co-host today. Your expertise was appreciated. Obviously, I was well beyond my depths on this, but thank you very much for all your insights.
Welcome, Ralph. It's nice to be here.
Yeah, we'll have to have both of you on some other time in the future. I think this was a really good time. If you like discussing data science and academic papers, much like we have been today, please subscribe to the feed. We release our podcast monthly and would love to have you along for the ride. If you have any questions or you want to reach out to us on the podcast, feel free to email us at thepaperclub@deeperinsights.com. And until next month, I am Raphael. I'm here with Tom and Simon, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.
Bye.